Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will sit down and discuss spring and things. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
You like that title there?
Yeah, that was a good title. That made me kind of giggle a little bit.
Well, you ought to. You made it up. I just read what's wrote down in front of me.
It's timely.
Yeah.
It is.
It is. We got things going on. Yeah, it's springtime.
We're about to get to spring. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not going to feel like it today where we are in the western part of Kentucky.
Yep. If you don't like Kentucky weather, I always tell people if you don't like it, just to hang around a day or so. And it'll change. And then it was, 70 here the other day? And it's going to be 19 tomorrow night. We're on a Friday. And 25 tonight and 19 tomorrow night on a Saturday night. So back in the 70s to the end of the week. So
I think the springtime. High this weekend is not supposed to be much out of the 30s here, I don't believe.
Yeah,
so.
I think it's right. Yeah.
So. I saw 41 on Sunday for my
okay.
area.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's
good day.
Yeah.
It'd be good temperatures.
It may not feel like spring this weekend, but it's still upon us.
You know, in the wheat that we have here locally is really been getting it here in the last little bit. Folks have really got the nitrogen on, and it's really made some strides. I'm hoping that this cold weather doesn't hurt it. But the only way to get out there, the only way to figure that out is to get out there and scout.
And there's a time period that you need to wait, too. Mm-hmm. I think you need to
– Yep.
You're going to have some warm weather and then –
I think I've always thought of scouting as a two-part deal. You need to know what's going on in your crop before a distinct weather event so that you'll know what to look for afterwards. Yeah. You said it, Vicki, there is a time frame you're supposed to wait. It's 48 hours maybe before you start looking
Yeah, I think that's close if that's not exactly right. But, close, but you can't go out a lot of times just that next day and be able to see anything.
You got to give it a day or two to see what's going to happen. But, I would think some producers are probably going to need to get out there and do that come about Tuesday, Wednesday-ish of next week. So,
big thing to remember is where your wheat is at growth stage-wise whenever you experience the cold weather. And just getting down to 32 is probably not enough to hurt it, especially if it's younger wheat. It hadn't been jointed yet. Mm-hmm. But on that same hand, when we do experience these below freezing temperatures, there's a little bit of duration time. It needs to be below that temperature for a couple hours
I'm thinking it's 24 degrees I forget how many hours. It's 2 or 3 hours
I think it's
or
two.
Something. Yeah. So, it just depends on what happens here in the next few days as to where we're going to end up. But, a few years ago, we've had the same thing happen a couple of times that I can remember.
Right.
And, some folks terminated some wheat that probably some other folks kept that wheat. And, it ended up turning out like 70 bushels, 60 bushels. So it wasn't a bust for sure. So, those are some decisions you're going to have to sit down and make after you figure out what's going on.
On that same hand, I've seen some people keep some wheat that they probably wish they would have got rid of.
Yeah.
Down in the southern part of the Pennyrowl region of Kentucky, where the big wheat belt for the state is, across from Simpson, Logan, Todd, Christian, Trigg counties through there, I've seen a lot of times where maybe the temperature at the local mesonet didn't get that low.
Right.
But we have so much variability in the topography of our fields. Mm-hmm. We'll have these low spots, and they'll have a little bit of lower temperature for the same duration, and those low spots might end up getting hurt, and the field as a whole look good. And a lot of times that can fool you.
Oh, absolutely. And, we got those little swags and bottoms and different things that we have in our area of western Kentucky, and so you have to deal with that. Not only look at the high spots, but look at the low spots as well and kind of make a determination from that.
One of the big things I've seen when we had some of those years where wheat got dinged pretty hard, it wasn't necessarily the freeze. I guess the freeze is what caused the dieback whenever it happened. But if you trace it back in time, it was warm weather in December and January.
Yep.
The wheat had too much growth on it.
Right.
I remember one year, wheat that shouldn't even have been jointed yet had two joints in it when we got a freeze. And that oftentimes is the real culprit. It's the warm weather later in the year, and it breaks dormancy and takes off growing.
Yeah.
Then we get a freeze.
Yeah, and I think we've had some pretty good – we've had some pretty warm weather for February.
We have.
In the first part of March here that have – you know, that's kind of gotten us in this situation. So I guess we'll see. And it all depends on, like Jay said, it all depends on how far along that weed is and what growth stage it is to how bad it does get hurt, if it does get hurt.
Wheat's actively growing right now. I looked at some wheat yesterday evening that could have used some nitrogen. Yeah. I mean, it started to look a little yellow, so you know it's growing. It's right. In need of it.
Right.
And it already had one shot, and it's growing out of that. So.
Right.
We don't want any snow, but in a situation like that, though, when we're having these freeze events like this, you know, that snow sometimes serves as a great insulation to protect that wheat plant. But we're not going to get any snow, and we don't want any snow. I'll just throw that out there. I only brought the snow up because we know how much David enjoys snow and how much he enjoys the cold weather, and so I just wanted to... You know, just to bring that up because of your enjoyment.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
He's done told me he was moving cattle all weekend, so he doesn't want any snow right now.
No, I don't want any snow. I really don't want any cold weather, but I mean, I think I'm going to have to endure through it. But
I will say, though, I think we got an article, us three agents here in Kentucky got some information from one of our specialists about possible freeze damage. So if you are in a county and you're listening and you're concerned about possible wheat damage after this cold weather runs through, you know, contact your extension office and, you know, those folks be able to try to walk you through how to check that and what things you need to check for and get you some good information to help you along the process and just another tool help to make decisions on what you need to do when that time comes. So.
Absolutely.
I've seen a little bit of information come out on that. I know Connor Raymond, our extension associate for Grand Crop, sent something out just this week.
That's right.
Yep. It's a topic that's on everybody's mind
right
now.
It is. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's that tough part about spraying when something like this happens. You know, I think about peach trees, too. I've gotten some calls this week about how do I protect my peach trees. Of course, that's from a person that just has a few peaches in their backyard. It's a little bit easier for them to try to construct something or do something to protect a few trees, but when you're talking about an orchard, that's not quite as easily done. And so these crazy weather conditions that we've been talking about and swings and high temperatures and light and then freezes, this isn't a late freeze, but it's just things have already started moving toward an early spring, you know,
again,
even Easter flowers.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's that warm temperature.
That's right.
A month ago that
exactly.
Bringing all this on.
And so absolutely. Lots of things it's going to be checked and I think there's a lot of people's going to be out checking a lot of things over the next 5, 6, 7 days.
Talk about things that we talk about in the spring, and that call from somebody with a backyard peach tree is always one of them. I know myself, I really try to lay out all the ins and outs of growing a peach in this part of Kentucky for those people who look at wanting to plant a few peach trees. It's going to be a deal where you might get a crop 2 out of every 5 years because of these freezes and losing blooms and whatnot. But a good peach is awful hard to beat.
It is.
Absolutely.
I agree.
A lot of people like them.
Yep.
That is right.
For sure.
So what's on everybody's mind today? It's spring where we've got a bull sale that we just had, inaugural bull sale. David, if you want to touch on some of that first.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit, and we didn't talk a lot about about the bull sale on our podcast, if I can spit it out. But it was one of those deals. This was the first one we've ever done. We didn't know how it was going to turn out, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But it really turned out well. It's the Kentucky-Tennessee Cowman's Kind Bull Sale. And we had 24 bulls there at the sale. They averaged 31.09, which we thought was pretty good, you know, for the time of year. We had for folks that don't know, we had a terrible windstorm the day before. Matter of fact, one of our producers coming down I-24 was right behind a semi that turned over right in front of them and skidded down I-24. So it was a terrible day. The crowd was not hardly as big as I'd like to have had, but the folks that did come were there to buy some bulls. So,
and that's the people you want there.
Well, that's right.
The ones that's going to buy.
You know, but it makes you awful doggone nervous at 11:30 when there's not hardly anybody in the stands, you know. So, but it turned out really good. We had several breeds represented. I was just going to run through the averages there for folks. We had a Hereford, set of three Hereford bulls that averaged $3,366. We had a black Hereford that averaged $3,000. We had some Sim Angus bulls that averaged 34, 33. We had some Angus bulls that averaged 2366. The Balancer bulls averaged 3400 even. The Gelvie bulls averaged $2,820. The two high-selling bulls was a Hereford and a Sim Angus that brought $4,300. Mm-hmm. So we were really tickled. The genetics were really on the bulls, the quality of the bulls. They had been through a whole battery of tests. PI tested negative. They had a current BSE, genomic tested bulls. So all those EPDs were genomically enhanced. So a really good sale that I think we had. And, you know, I think folks were really pleased with it. So I think we're going to try to do it again next year. Good. The one thing I have learned is you got to start way earlier than when I did to get all the genomic testing back. It just takes some time to get that DNA work and the genomic, the EPDs to be genomically enhanced. It just takes a little more time to get that done than a week or two. You know, so we're going to start in the fall talking to our consigners, hopefully have all that information done by the Christmas, you know, and try to get our catalog out a little quicker, too. We had some trouble getting that done because of we were waiting on EPDs and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So first time, we learned a lot. It was a video sale. I don't know if I mentioned that or not, but the bulls did not come in the ring. They were all on the TV screens. We took videos of all the bulls. That's why, how we sold them. Seemed like that worked really good. The bulls didn't have to come in. You didn't have to get them stirred up, you know, and they just remained a lot calmer, and that was a lot better.
But the bulls were all on site for bulls, somebody that wanted to look at them.
Absolutely. The bulls were there on site. We were able to pin them with other bulls that the producers brought, the same producers brought. They were a lot calmer. It was just a lot better of a situation, and that's what we want. And, you know, we want producers to come in there and get in the pens and look at the bulls. And we had it where you could go down beside each side of the bulls, so you could look at both either way you wanted to look at them. And, you know, it went really well, and it worked really well, and we're going to try to have it again, I think, next year.
That'll be a good thing. You know, just glancing across the catalog, I know our counterpart, Matt Futrell in Christian County, yep. And Diane Turner, one of his staff assistants,
did a fantastic job.
She worked, yep, to help get that done. But,
yes,
you know, just glancing across it, it was a smaller sale. But the, mm-hmm, thing that I liked about it is it was a little bit of something for everyone.
Everybody. Yep.
Across the range of producers, there, right, was some kind of bull at that sale that would have fit your needs.
Right. And the reason we started that sale is because we've got a lot of smaller producers that only have 3, 4, 5 bulls that they produce every year. And we like to give them an opportunity to be in that kind of a sale, that kind of setting that gets in front of a lot more people than just coming to your farm to buy bulls. And a lot of times you don't hear about that unless it's word of mouth or that kind of thing. So I think, you know, we started it, and hopefully it's going to continue and to grow. And, you know, the thing about it is the more producers we have, we can be a little more selective on the quality of the bulls that we have in our sale. And that's what I'm hoping happens next year, is we get at even more quality to those bulls.
So if somebody is wanting to consign, I mean, what's the process for that? I mean, is there going to be a time period there that you're going to people be talking to you, wanting to consign, yeah, them, or just walk through the process for,
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, the best thing they can do is get a hold of me, and you can call me at the McLean County Extension Office, 270-273-3690, and I can get you the information, and we'll have a time there in the fall that we're going to have a consigner meeting. We're That's probably cool. going to have a couple of them just in different locations so folks don't have to drive as much, because, yeah, we've got some producers in Tennessee, and we've got some producers all the way over in Bowling Green and further Scottsville. Mm-hmm. We've got some producers in Hardinsburg. So, you know, they just need to get a hold of me, and I need to get them on the list. And then when we have our consigner meetings, you know, they can express their interest and, you know, maybe how many bulls they might would have. And then we can kind of start paring those down from there.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't need to have – all bulls don't need to be in this sale. You know, as it becomes more popular, I hope to be able to, you know, select even better bulls for our sale every year. So, mm-hmm, hopefully the quality will continue to get better every year we do this. So that's kind of what we're aiming for. So if you just get a hold of me, and we'll get you hooked up.
I think it's a great idea, and it's a great thing that you did for the producers in that area, but not just in that area. I mean, it can cover a lot of different areas, not just where that sale barn is. And
yep,
I think that just gives a lot of producers just more opportunities and more outlets to be able to buy,
yeah,
you know, to buy what they need to match their herd.
Right.
And And I think it's in a setting, like you had said, it's in a setting that works well for those smaller growers and and I just think that's an excellent thing. I know I've got a producer that mm-hmm. was telling me just a couple mm-hmm. of weeks ago it didn't work out for him to be in it this year, but right. he's really looking forward to hopefully being yep. able to be in to bring some yep. bulls down there next year. So I'm excited for that for him.
Yeah, it's a producer friendly sale, and it's also a buyer friendly sale. There's no high pressure. The auctioneer that's there at the Kentucky Tennessee Livestock Market is it's just like the bred heifer sale. We're going to catch everybody, and he's not going to pressure you, we're not going to run the bid on you or anything sure. like that. So it's a very much a producer friendly and consigner friendly sale on both sides of it.
Well, and with the CAPE programs and the cost share programs yep. that we've had in the state of Kentucky now for 20 years or more, I guess. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a lot of bulls purchased mm-hmm. That has received cost share. And so a lot of times, when somebody starts looking for a bull, they're asking, well, is this going to qualify for cost share? And so I think it's yeah. nice on your bulletin that you are your catalog that you mm-hmm. had it was on there. Yes, it was, or no, it wasn't. I yes. think that is great. And I think that's something that yep. hopefully will stay in there.
And Tennessee has that same cost share program. The requirements are a little different, and sometimes they'll qualify for one or they don't qualify for the other one. But this first year we had, I think, probably 16, 18 of the bulls qualified for cost share, and the other ones did not. The other ones were just as good a quality. It didn't have anything to do with the quality of the bull. It's just that they didn't meet those requirements, and mm-hmm. it could have been a half a point. A point off or something, it was just very minimum a lot of times when they didn't make those requirements.
But there's still a lot of bulls that's purchased that's never turned in for cost share. So there's still a need for bull. I mean, those bulls still have a home to go yep. to, yep. even if they don't meet the criteria for right. that cost share program, because yep. there's a lot of people that either their county doesn't have mm-hmm. that program available to them, mm-hmm. for whatever reason. Some counties don't even get enough funds
yep.
to be able to offer a program like yep. that. And so that, like you said, it's not a negative thing that they don't right. qualify. It's just,
And I think going forward, we'll probably continue to have some bulls that don't qualify just because of the quality of the bull.
Because they're quality bulls.
I mean, it's just, from a phenotypical standpoint, I mean, they look the part and are the part. And, they just, because their EPDs are not, doesn't mean they don't have some genetic potential that mm-hmm. they can add to a herd.
Going back to what I said earlier, doesn't matter what kind of producer you are, there was something in this mm-hmm. sale for
Absolutely.
You. And bulls like that often have a place yep. in a breeding herd. It may yep. just not be a heifer bull, for instance, right. or mm-hmm. something along those lines.
It may be one that you don't want to put on heifers, and that's kind of the EPDs kind of help you select the bulls. If you've got a bunch of heifers you're trying to breed and one doesn't qualify for that, you probably don't want to use him for mm-hmm. that.
You've got a large enough herd and you're dealing with a lot of mature yeah. cows, a growthy type bull, something to mm-hmm. make a little bit bigger calf and select
exactly.
for growth is
exactly. Yeah.
Well, so. I think too, just with that sale, and I think that the clientele is going to know that mm-hmm. there's not going to be bulls in it that aren't quality bulls. Yep. I mean, because yep. y'all have a committee that of folks
you're going to pre-screen them,
you're going to look at them, you're going to know a lot about those bulls before they ever get consigned, yep. and so just the reputation of that sale, mm-hmm. That people's going to know ahead of time. There's not going to be a quality, issue with a bull that's there.
Yeah. And that's what we hope to build on. So we'll see how it goes next year. But, I mean, we're really excited about this. I think it's going to be something good for the area.
Yeah. Well, I think it's exciting and glad it went well and looking forward to next year.
I was going to say looking forward to it and looking forward to helping you with it if there's a way we can, as agents. Oh. We do a lot of things together.
Get ready.
I think he's already got jobs for us, Jay.
Well, it's more work than people think, getting all that information together. And the producers were doing the best they could. We were just waiting on that genomic information. That was the holdup a lot of times. And, just getting all that information, gathering that information into one spot, and then getting that to the people that were working on the catalog and, all that kind of stuff. So hopefully, I guess that's the one thing I did learn is we're going to get started a lot earlier this next time. Mm-hmm. So
sure.
Well, I mean, that's the name of the game is we continue to learn.
Yep.
And if we ever stop continuing to learn, we're in trouble.
Yep.
So we just got to know what we got to work on next time and do better.
Well, that's the thing. I think it may take four or five of these sales before you really feel comfortable knowing what everybody's role needs to be, because it's going to grow every year, and with growth you'll have new challenges.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and the thing about it, we don't want to get too many. You know, we don't want to flood the market, because there's still a market for those bulls that are sold off the farm, that kind of stuff. But we want you to bring your quality bulls to this sale. We think we can help you get a little more money for them than just selling them off the farm.
Well, and it's just a lot of advertisement and a lot of PR for those individual consigners that they're not having to do, because somebody else is doing it for them.
Yep.
And then there's going to be – but I feel certain, though, that there'll be people at that sale that maybe bought – even if they didn't buy one, but they know who is at that sale, which could lead to them contacting them to purchase another bull off the farm. Yep.
Think about the buyers that attend a sale like this. You've already promoted for them the types of bulls and all the details about the bulls, but you said you had 24 consigned to sale. The average producer is not going to have time to go to 24 different farms looking
at
sale. Coming to a sale like this, they're going to have a lot more opportunity to look at a larger set of quality bulls than they would ever have time to get around and individually meet on the farm.
Yeah, I forget how many miles I drove, you know, looking at different bulls. And we didn't just make one visit. We made just about two visits to every farm. You know, we went back and looked early, probably 1st of January, and then we went back again in February and looked again. And, you know, we try to get all of those, you know, if there's any kind of, you know, feet and leg issues, we try to get all that knocked out and everything done. So when you come to the sale to buy a bull, you know you're going to be looking at some quality bulls. So that's what we try to do.
So good.
It worked out good. It was certainly a success.
So, that's good.
Yep.
Sounds good. Where to next?
I think we ought to hit the soil testing. I mean, I think it's this is something that's pretty, pretty well fixing to have to happen pretty quick. So
it is, and you know, we talked a lot about last year, you know, over last year's podcast and the weather conditions and just a lot of things. But you know, it was pretty dry, you know, last fall.
Pretty dry is not the word.
It was really dry.
It's pretty dry.
Yeah.
Depending on where you were at, if you were in the Mecca up here in Webster County, you didn't have any trouble getting a soil probe in.
Everywhere else in Kentucky, but you know, soil testing was a little tough last fall. So, you know, we can't say enough how important soil tests are, and I think still they get overlooked and they don't get taken near enough. And I think that, I mean, I'll still keep preaching this same thing, but soil testing is money well spent. The results that you're going to get from that, I mean, it's going to help you. You may be applying too much, you may not be applying enough, but either way, there's beneficial information there. And so, you know, and with last year's conditions the way they were, it was tough. And so, now is the time, get out there and get those soil tests. I mean, because it's going to change here in a hurry, and you're going to be planting and ready to go. And so,
you know, not to chase a rabbit, but let's chase one real quick. I wonder what the percentage of people are that say, come into this fertilizer dealer, say, well, I just want some triple 19. Well, have you taken a soil test in the last 4 or 5 years? I bet there's folks that have not, and they say, well,
absolutely.
I'm just putting on triple. I talked to a guy last night, said he's putting on triple 19.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, but I didn't say, because you learn these things through extension. You don't always say what's on your mind. I wanted to say, well, have you taken a soil test? And you know, and when was the last time you took a soil test? And, you know, and I'm guessing it's been a long time.
I think there's a large percentage of folks that just do the same thing every year. And like I said, triple 19, or, you know, going in before corn and putting 400 pounds of 923-30. I mean, that's a, you know, and you just don't stop to, you just think that's I've been doing this for years, and that's the way we've always done it.
That's what makes my crop. Yeah, that's what makes I make a good crop every year, so why change?
Yeah, and do the same thing on lime. We'll say, well, man, I hadn't limed here in a few years, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to put a couple tons of lime on. You're laughing, but you know that happens.
That's right.
And I mean, and I guess if that's the way somebody wants to do, we can't tell you not to do it, but I can tell you that that soil tests are important, and
it saves you money.
It saves you money,
yeah.
And it can make you money.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Both ways.
Both ways, and it doesn't take that long to do it.
The example there though about the lime, the difference between it and fertilizer is I've never seen anybody waste money on lime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sometime or another, it's going to benefit them to have it. And if they're just automatically doing it every 3 or 4 years, that's probably what's keeping that fertilizer blend that they're using working.
You're right. That's exactly right, Jay. Yeah, because we do know that if the soil pH is off, then the fertilizer is not being utilized at its potential, for sure.
Even then, I have seen a couple of instances that where a pH got too high, and just mm-hmm. like a too low a pH, you bring in a whole different level of elements in the soil that become available to plants. Aluminum is one of those things that's on the higher mm-hmm. end. Manganese on the lower mm-hmm. end. But either one of them can cause buildups and problems in plants.
So that's exactly right.
Keeping that pH optimum is the first step, and you need a soil test to do that.
And you know, even with our fertilizer prices where they are now, I mean, they've come down considerably in the last little bit, but you still, I mean, it's still higher than it used to be, you know, even back when it was, you know, halfway reasonable, you know. But how much money can we, you know, how much money can we save by doing a soil test, by simply doing a soil test mm-hmm. and applying the correct amount instead of just throwing out the 923-23.
Even there, that's a two-part deal, though. I know a lot of people that soil test, and then we'll keep right on fertilizing.
That's true.
Just especially in a garden, I see that every year.
Mm-hmm.
They'll soil test every other year to know where they're at, but then they keep applying that P and K especially.
And a lot of times you're putting 50 pounds of fertilizer on a tenth of an acre or something like that, too. I mean, because, you know, those levels get really high. And that's something worth talking about, too, is because – you don't want your soil test, you know, P and K to get too high. I mean, there's a place we want that, you know, and once you get there, then, you know, then we can start looking at, you know, maintenance type fertilizers and removals and things like that. But, you know, you can get that too high. We see that sometimes with chicken litter use.
That's what I was fixing to say.
And so we have to really watch that. So if that is your fertilizer source, using chicken litter, then you really need to be soil testing, because you really do not want to get those levels too high. It is hard to get those levels back down once you've got them too high, you know, and so we really need to be soil testing. And some of the things when you are taking soil tests to keep in mind is don't take a soil test at an old fence row or something like that. The other thing is, most people talking about the lime will go back to spreading lime, throwing, you know, putting our 2 tons on every so many years. We tend to stockpile that lime and dump that lime in the same place in that field too, every time that you lime the field. Stay out of that area. When you take in your cores for your sample, just stay out of that area. Anything like that, just kind of avoid those. And when you're out in the field and taking those, you know, just take random cores throughout the field. Don't get in a pattern of a straight line. Don't, you know, just kind of do zigzag through that field and taking those samples, and because that sample is only going to be as good as you take, you know, the results are only going to be as good as the sample that you get. And so, just kind of keep those things in mind. And the other thing that, we want to keep in mind is the depth that we're soil sampling, because that's going to make a difference on the results that come in. And so, you know, if you are in a tillage situation where you're working that ground, then you do want to take that sample a little bit deeper, you know, about 6 to 8 inches in a tilled situation. But if you are in a no-till or minimum till situation, you need to stay in that 3 to 4 inches. You really do not need to go any deeper than that to get accurate results for what you're, you know, for that situation. So, you know, just keep that in mind as well. But on talking about the lawns and turf grass, because we do get a lot of those too, we need to soil sample those too. But again, keep those at that 3 to 4, you know, 4 inch depth. And if you're going to be sampling for your garden and you're going to be sampling for your lawn, you need to do those separately, because the recommendations for those are vastly different, and so you do want to keep those separate. So, but the main thing is to get out there and get those in. In Kentucky, you know, we have a soil testing lab. You can bring those soil samples in to the extension offices, and we'll get the paperwork done, and we send those in. And usually we have the results, usually 7 to 14 days. Sometimes a little quicker. Sometimes it's closer to that two-week mark, depending on the time of year and how many samples are coming in. There are certain times of year that's going to be a little bit longer wait. So
that's a good point. Right now, you know, if you think about the fact we're in the third week of March, 2023, for years, University of Kentucky has maintained two soil test labs, one in Princeton, one in Lexington, and one in Princeton, of course, along with the rest of the research station, got destroyed in the tornado in December of 2021. Until we have that back, all of our soil testing responsibilities fall upon that Lexington lab. So it being spring, my suggestion is if you listen to this, you know, in a timely manner around the time that it's recorded, is go on and get that sample in so we can get it up there and get it back, because we're probably fixing to hit a slowdown in the next month or so, mm-hmm. I'd say.
Yeah, I agree. And so just get those in. If you've got any questions about, you know, how to sample a field or suggestions, because there's a lot of different ways, you know, I think you have talked about, David, before in a previous podcast, you know, on fields, you know, sometimes you can do that by soil type, mm-hmm. or you can do that, you know, just separating your fields by zones. And just, you could, there's a lot of different ways that you can do that, that will fit into your operation and what you're looking for. You know, we say as a rule of thumb, you know, a sample per 20 acres or so. You know, you don't want to, if you've got 100 acres to sample, you know, you need to break that up into 20 acres or so if you can, and to be representative of the results that you're, that's going to be more useful to you, the information you're going to get back from that. And
yeah, and is, there's nothing that says that when you get those samples back in a, say you're in a 100 acre field, that you can't blend that fertilizer.
Absolutely.
To kind of hit the middles or hit the high spots. You know, we have people in the pasture situation that do that all the time, mm-hmm. because, you know, every field is going to be different. So you try to get towards the middle and just kind of hit them all, because it's so hard to, who's got time to run back every field and get mm-hmm. a different buggy of fertilizer.
To get them in the middle, though, you need to sample all the different mm-hmm. parts of
that's
that
right.
field, so you
that's
know
right.
what you're looking at.
And that's that, right. And it does show you some spots, like, but you may, like, doing all those different fields, and in your mind, we're thinking we're gonna come up with a middle of the road that's going to yeah. work for all. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that will show you why certain fields are not doing the way you want it to
that's
do,
right.
particularly in a pasture, is clover. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're trying to you know, integrate a legume into your pasture, and you're just not having luck, and you are doing the planting conditions right mm-hmm. and all that, it may be a pH issue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, it
more
may be
likely.
A lower potassium mm-hmm. issue. You may mm-hmm. have a really low soil test potassium that's causing problems. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes those soil tests will kind of key you in on why you might be seeing what you're seeing during the growing season.
Another reason to take a soil test.
Another reason
really,
to take a soil
really
test.
Good reason to take
and
it.
On that note, if you are having, if there is a place in your, in if it be pasture or if it be corn, soybeans, tobacco, whatever, that you just feel like is just not doing as well, sample that area separate
yeah.
from the rest. So
good
we can
point.
Really get a look at what that area of the field is doing and how, why is that different from a different area of the field. So there is cases that you do sample separately a smaller area, mm-hmm. especially for diagnostic type things that we're looking for.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the 20-acre rule, and that's what our publication recommends, and I think that's a good thing to go by if it's all uniform, like mm-hmm. you mentioned. I think of my own place. I have one field that's about 8 acres in size, but there's a pretty distinct topography change. Mm-hmm. It's a side of a hill that rolls into an upper bottom, or a contour-type field that rolls down into a bottom. And you can look at that and tell there's going to be probably a minimum of three different soil series that changes. Even though that's only 8 acres, I make that three different mm-hmm. soil tests, because it's, you're dealing with three totally different types of ground.
That's right. So. And, you know, Kentucky soil, there's a lot of fields that fall in that same description. There's a lot of differences and a lot of
soil types,
a lot of soil yeah. types, a lot of you know, topography is in the same field, a lot of differences and changes. And
you know, that's especially important. Well, it's in all of our fields now, but I mean, it's especially important in pasture fields because a lot of the times those are fields that folks can't work,
right,
and can't crop. And but we've got some places that folks are cropping that the topography is very different, you know, from just from here to there is very different. So that's very important, and you know, folks need to take that in consideration when they're pulling their soil samples.
That's right.
So
you know, you talked about worked ground, and there is a lot of fields being cropped right now, especially up in the central part of the state that were pasture for a lot of years. One thing to think about on those different types of grounds specific to crops is the variety of seeds you're planting as well. If you're planting corn, have a variety that's really tailored to that type of ground, because it's going to change pretty quick. Typically what changes is the water requirement of a particular variety as you go from a terrace type field into a bottom.
Yeah, you know, and back in the day, and that's been a minute, you could get a variety and just plant your whole farm in that variety. And now it is, you know, our genetics have changed so much that you really need to put a lot of thought into the types of varieties that you're planting on the different soil types. I mean, it means to me, to be the most efficient, you've got to do that every year. Year in, year out, you've got to do that.
And it's one of those things that probably ought to be done back in December.
Oh, absolutely.
So that you can make sure you've got that particular seed available from your representative whenever the time comes.
Yeah, you know, the bad part, I always used to tell people about tobacco. By the time we got finished with tobacco, we were already making plant beds again for the next crop.
It used to be that way.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, in today's time, that's kind of true the way crop is. You've got to be thinking about your inputs. You've got to be thinking about what varieties you're going to plant, what chemicals you're going to, you know, what chemical program you're going to use the next year. You know, even from an availability standpoint, to try to get all that locked in probably before Christmas, to be real honest.
Well, and just like the conversation David and I had yesterday with a couple of producers after the dicamba meeting, you know, we was talking to a couple of producers, and we was talking about different sources of nitrogen, different ways, you know, we was talking about side dressing and pre-plant and things, and moving more away from anhydrous and more toward like your liquid fertilizers, or in this particular case, we was talking about
ESN
urea. And in that situation, they had locked in what they wanted, you know, early on. And because you have to, you know, obviously, and you got to make those decisions. And I mean, in this scenario, they were kind of backing up and maybe hoping to try something different. And, but even if they can't do that this year because they're locked in, that is something that they've already started thinking about, though, for the next growing season.
Right, right.
You know, so I think you're right. They don't ever stop thinking. And I think a lot of times now in the combines, you've got the seed reps in there with them now talking about the different varieties and where, you know, what's going where next year. Mm-hmm. So those decisions are being talked about really early, a lot earlier than they used to be.
Oh, definitely. And I know Vicki just made mention of the dicamba training that we had yesterday. You know, in the show notes, I think you'll find the links to the dicamba training online, dicamba training, and Jay was probably fixing to talk about that.
I had my phone in my hand, and Vicki had emailed me those links earlier, also the link to that D128 publication that she's been referencing. Those will all be available in the show notes. But, you know, the dicamba trainings are one of those things. The past few years, they have gone from being some of the largest attended meetings that we have every year to now some of the smaller ones. But a lot of that's because it's available online. A lot of producers are becoming more comfortable with doing that online, and it's serving them well. But it's still out there and still available. I had a good crowd there at your office yesterday, I felt like, for the time of the year that it was. And
I actually had a guy call me this morning and said, "Hey, man, I didn't feel very good yesterday. Is there anywhere I can go to get that?" And I sent him the link. You know, so those are available at your extension office. Your extension agent should be able to find that for you and, you know, help you try to get that dicamba training done.
There's a couple, I think, options of way to do that, too. You can do a self-paced online where you can kind of do that on your own time schedule, and I think you can even start and stop that. Don't quote me on that because I haven't done it, but I was thinking somebody said that, but you better check before you get out of that. But I think it's the pace yourself. And then I think there is a test with that. So just keep that in mind. You know, pay attention.
Pay
attention because you're going to have to pass that test at the end. And then there's where they do a guided live webinar. They do that, I think it's every Tuesday morning maybe at 9 a.m., mm-hmm. I think.
That's right.
That you can.
Eastern time, isn't that right?
No, I think it was Central, the one that I looked at.
I couldn't remember.
But just check that wherever you, sure. For our listeners, just check that. But you do have to register for that. So just make sure that you get in there and do that. But if you do intend to buy or to use dicamba, mm-hmm. You do need to have that dicamba specific training.
Even if you're sitting there going, I'm not going to use it, I don't think I'm going to fool with it, you know, getting that training, it won't take very long. And then if you get into season and you have that type of genetics in your field and you mm-hmm. go, I've got to do something, you know, and this is maybe my only option, then you've already got that training out of the way. You don't have to worry about that. All of that stuff. So try to get all of that done ahead of time. So then if you have to be stuck in that position, then you're able to come out of it and go right. Purchase those chemicals to be able to rescue that field or whatever you're trying to do.
Well, it's better to have it, not need it, than need it, not have it.
That's right. All the time.
Yeah.
that's a lot of stuff.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. You're right.
It is.
Yep. That's right. Vicki, I know you did some stuff on gardening on the ID 128. We've got that link to that publication in our show notes. And kind of tell folks a little bit about that real quick.
Yeah, just that publication itself, ID 128, is an excellent publication for anybody that wants to grow vegetables, that, you know, whether that be in a high tunnel or whether that be in a backyard garden, if you like to start your own seed, you know, transplants with seeds and growing those out. There's just, or even container gardens. There's a lot of information in that ID 128, and it is written in such a way that it's for homeowners. It's not written for commercial production. And so everything, the way that the publication is laid out, the information is in it, is very user-friendly to homeowners and those types of folks. So just wanted to take a moment to make sure that remind everybody that it's be aware of when that last frost killing
frost free date.
That's it. Yep. Thank you for helping me out on that. Is because there I have seen years not too long ago that everybody got the opportunity to plant their tomatoes three times. And every time that they planted them, other than the last time, mm-hmm. they were planting them in that critical time period where we still can get that killing frost. And so, you know, depending on where you are and where you're listening, just know where that date is.
Yep.
And pay attention to that, because there are some crops that do not survive a little bit of frost.
Yeah.
And, you know, so keep that in mind. For our area that we're in here, and like I said, the western part of Kentucky, we're looking at that late April to May the 2nd, 3rd, 5th, somewhere in that time period. But when it gets warm and it's April the 2nd and it's 80 degrees, then the next weekend we always see gardens going in. And then we almost always are going to get that. And we're not finished with the freezes. So keep that in mind.
I'm going to lay a little old folk knowledge on y'all. For those folks that are listening,
go ahead, because I was fixing to.
Okay.
No, go
well,
ahead.
One of the older gentlemen that lived close to me, he would plant his tomatoes early, but then he cut bottoms out of these buckets, mm-hmm. and he would put those around them. And then if it was to get cold, like it's fixing to this weekend, he'd put a little something on top of it, but then he'd take it off, you know, when he got ready the next day. Yep. So, you know, that helps a bunch. That'll get you way ahead on the tomato growing business. But you know, and I've used old coffee, the plastic coffee cans, mm-hmm.
right.
And used them. They're not as tall, is the only problem. But he used to use, I think he had a bunch of 2 gallon buckets, mm-hmm. and plastic buckets that he had cut the bottom out of, and he just put those around his tomato plants and worked like a charm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind. If you're going to plant them early, that'd be the way to go.
I thought you were going to reference a safe planting date. And you know, I've heard that date being Easter, but Easter changes every year, different times of the year. But Derby Day, first Saturday in mm-hmm. May. And I've always heard that that was the old saying way back when is wait till Derby Day to plant your tomatoes. Of course, where I grew up in the central part of the state, Derby Day, it's typically a little cooler than it is in this end of the world.
Right.
It does change depending on where you are, even in even in the state of Kentucky. Those those zones are different.
Western ends a little earlier than over in eastern Kentucky and central Kentucky. But
elevation change is what makes that difference. And that's the same way in the spring as it is in the fall. In the fall, our first frost date might be a week to 10 days after they're seeing it in the central and eastern part of the state.
Absolutely.
But just keep that in mind. And if that publication, if you're in need of that publication, get a hold of your extension office. And other extension services will have a publication like that as well if you're not in Kentucky. So.
There is a lot of information packed in that one publication. Mm-hmm. If you go back through our files on this show, go back to last year, Vicki and I did a show just on the ID 128 Home Garden and Pub. It was our intentions in 45 minutes to talk about the whole publication, and we didn't get past the first two pages because there's a lot of basic laid out information right there at the front that's beneficial for everyone.
That's right.
That's right.
That is right.
Well, folks, let's roll right on into our timely tip for this week. We started off this show talking about livestock, talking about our bull sales, so kindly to go back to that theme. Timely tip for this week is to be sure and get all your vaccines purchased and those cows worked before your spring breeding season. I think, David, we talked about 30 days is primarily when that needs to be.
Yeah, you need to, do it at least 30 days before breeding season. So, you know, that's for folks that are going to calve the 1st of February, that's coming up fairly quickly, you know. So folks need to get all that done. And, you know, it just makes things go a lot better when you get all those vaccinations taken care of. You may have to run them through the chute another time or two, but, I mean, it's to me is well worth it, you know, and doing those all those BQCA practices that we should be doing anyway. So just a good herd health program is very important for sure.
You know, aside from the benefits that the cow receives from it, getting your cows up and working them will help you have the ability to recognize a lot of issues before they get too bad. If you have something going on, you're more than likely picking it up by working your cattle.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just like looking at crops or just looking at anything else. The more you put your eyes on it, the more stuff you're going to catch and try to get ahead of that stuff, you know, just like equipment or whatever. You know, if you can get it in there and get it fixed beforehand, goes a lot better during the years. Cows the same way.
Sounds good. Well, folks, I appreciate it. Everybody had a good show and had a lot to add today. We want to thank our hosts for this week's information, and also thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.